you have your Bibles, keep them out to Hosea chapter 9. We're going to look specifically at the last verse that we read, verse 10, and we'll develop it going back and forth as we need to. Let's reread verse 10. It says, "I found Israel like grapes in the wilderness." This is a reference back to Jeremiah. "I saw your fathers in the first ripe and the fig tree at her first time. But they, being Israel, went to Baal Peor and separated themselves unto that shame." And here's the phrase, "Their abominations were according as they loved." The title of the message tonight is "You Live as You Love." Now, setting everything in context, we know the book of Hosea, the first book of the minor prophets, starts with terrible tragedy. Hosea goes by order of God to marry a certain woman. I don't believe Hosea knew the type of woman she was. But married the woman, and she left several times and had several children with other men who were not Hosea. And as God is using this illustration to teach Israel, just the deprivation of the human mind and of human men. And we come all the way through God using Hosea as an illustration, and it comes down to chapter 9, verse 10, and God says, listen, the reason they're like this, the reason they go after these abominations is because they love them. They're not doing what's not natural to them. They're doing what they love. Now, as we look at the title, "You Live as You Love," I submit, if I had the opportunity to watch you for one solid week, I could find out what you love based on the amount of free time you spend with it. Now, yes, in the course of a week, we all spend in the neighborhood of 40 hours at work. So you can't say, well, you love work based on that time. Not necessarily. Where your free time goes, where the time that you're not obligated to certain things, that often shows where your true love lies. The word abomination, though, is a very strong word. Back in Proverbs chapter 6, verse 16, Solomon writes about six things that God hates, yea, seven are an abomination unto him. Now, what he's actually doing, using the comparison, Solomon's making the argument stronger. God hates six things, but that seventh thing, or adding these seven things together, it's an abomination, a word stronger than hate. Now, the things that they're doing are not just, well, they're bad. They are abominations before God. More than God hating it, God absolutely abhors the things that they're doing. But they love them. So what do you do? Well, let's find out in verse 10 what this love, the love of abomination, leads them to. The very first thing that sin always leads to, we find in verse 10. About halfway down, it says, "But they went to Baal Peor." We'll discover who that is in just a moment. "And separated themselves." A love of sin always brings a separation. When it comes to the Christian, a love for sin or a lifestyle of sin always leads to the separation of fellowship with God. Not of relationship, but of fellowship. The love of sin leads to the separation often from friends and family. Being addicted often, not just to substances, but many other things that we find good. Sports, television, internet. These things bring out separation. And the separation, just as sure as holiness, is a twofold separation. We say that holiness is a separation from the world and a separation to the Lord. A separation with sin is a twofold separation just the same. The first part of that separation, though, is from the Lord. As you go forward, a couple minor prophets, you find Jonah. God speaks to Jonah, telling him to go to Nineveh. Jonah is a man who's in sin at the time, a very prejudiced man against the Assyrians. God tells Jonah to go, but Jonah is in his sin, and Jonah loves his sin. He's happy with his bias, his prejudice against certain people. And so rather than going to Nineveh, he goes the complete opposite direction to Tarshish, and the phrase in there, it says, "from the presence of the Lord." Going back to where this takes place, Joshua and Judges, you find the cycle. Sin, separation, slavery, salvation, supplication, and background again. Their sin leads to separation from the Lord. Over in Revelation, I believe it's chapter 2, it talks about the first church, the church of Ephesus. The church had quite a bit going for them, but their one problem, do you remember what it was? They left. They separated themselves from their first love. sin and a love for sin always leads to a separation, not only from God, but in this case here is a separation to Baal Peor. Now, this is a very specific God. Israel had gotten into trouble worshiping terrible things. Gods like Molech, which were worshipped by the sacrifice of children. Baal Peor is not much better. The mention of Baal Peor goes all the way back to Numbers chapter 25. I'll recap the story so you don't have to turn there. Balaam, a prophet, a supposed prophet of God, was helping Balak, a king of Moab, to trick Israel and destroying themselves. And at Baal Peor, Balaam got the people to worship Baal Peor. Now, Baal Peor was a god that was only worshipped through immorality, drinking and dancing, fornication and adultery. And it was the worship of Baal Peor that God brought a severe judgment upon Israel. 25,000 people died in a plague that God sent. Now, with all this happening, God judges the people. A man named Phinehas stops the plague with a very bold, confident move. And now we find Israel going back to Baal Peor. You might wonder, does no one read a history book? 25,000 people died from the worship of this God, and we're going back to him now? Why would you do that? Well, because they love their sin. They love the abomination. They go back to it. Separation, they left the Lord. Now, what do they leave the Lord for? Well, we finished the phrase there. They separated themselves unto that, second S here is, shame. Anytime we leave the Lord for whatever good cause we might feel it to be, whether it be promotion at work, whether it be some kind of family function, whatever it is that we leave the Lord for, it is always a shameful thing. Whatever we love more than God is always a shameful thing in its context. Again, the word abomination is a very strong thing. What they loved affected the way they lived, and that's always the case. Because they loved their abominations, they were willing to separate themselves to that shame. Their love affected their lifestyle. And this is always, always true. And the greater their love, the greater the effect. Where our church is in New Jersey, North Bergen, it's just a few miles from Giants Stadium, the new Giants Stadium. And even on winter days, cold December, January days, if there's a home football game, without fail, there are people out there hours before the game tailgating. Now, it could be 15 degrees outside, snowing, cold wind chill of negative 400. It would not matter to these people because they love the Giants. It doesn't matter what day, what time, they will get off work, they will close everything out, shut their family out for those hours because they love football. What they love affects the way they live. And the greater their love leads to the greatness of their insanity at times with their love of it. You see, if you're familiar with football at all, the Green Bay Packers up in the frozen tundra up there. You can watch during playoff time, people will take off their shirts just to show their love for the Packers. Packers all the way across their chest in freezing weather. They love them. And what they love affects the way they live. And in college, there was an area called the bookstore, which had all our mail. And so when you had to go check your mail, you had to go to the bookstore. It's the only way it was. But in the bookstore, there were always groups that would congregate. They would gather. And it'd always be the most mushy, gushy couples would just camp out in the bookstore. And if you were going up to check your mail, they'd be sitting there, not talking, no form of communication. And there was a 6-inch rule or whatever inch rule it was. And so they would abide by it, but they would almost measure it out. I mean, they'd be right across from the other one. The guy would be staring right at the girl with this dumb look on her face, and the girl right back at her. And every time you go check your mail, come on, go somewhere else, you know, the back of the bookstore, somewhere, behind some kind of building, you know, out of sight. We don't want to see all that. And you'd go up there, but they were in love, and it affected their life. They weren't studying, they weren't doing well on their tests, but they loved that other person, and it affected the way they live. And you'd go up to the bookstore and you just pray, Lord, make one of them sneeze. Just one of them. You know, blah, all over the other one. What they loved affected the way they lived. Now, we think that whatever it is that we're living for and we're loving, we feel we have great control of it. However, we've got to be very careful. how it can go from us having control of the situation to us being controlled by the situation very, very quickly. Another college story. When I was in college, I worked for a golf course. I worked for the clubhouse, and I was the cart boy. I cleaned out the carts. It wasn't glamorous. It didn't pay a lot. I'm not sure why I worked there. I hate golf. But that's where I worked. And there was, between the clubhouse and the first hole, there was the steepest, most dangerous hill you have ever seen in your life. It went down. It was windy. It was in a shaded area, so if it was wet, if it rained the night before, it'd still be wet down, and it wouldn't dry. And some of us real smart cart boys decided we could go down that hill as fast as the golf cart would let us. Now, if you golf any, you know that golf carts have three gears. They have forward, which you can go about 8 miles an hour in forward. Then you have reverse. You can go about 4 miles an hour in reverse. Now, if you pop that thing into neutral, you can go as fast as the Lord and the laws of physics allow you to go. And that's what we decided to do. So I was by myself, and I thought, you know, we'd done it before with other guys. I thought, I can handle this. I've seen it done. I can control this thing. And so popped it into neutral. And down I went. And for the first 5 feet or so, I had control of the thing. And before long, at about 97 miles an hour, I realized I do not have control of this thing. It is taking me where it wants to go. And so I tried using the brake. Well, golf carts, the brakes are really just for show. Someone put them on as a joke. They don't do anything. I hit the brake and it was still wet. And so the golf cart, which was speeding, began to slide. Now I'm not going straight, I'm kind of going this direction. And then I hit some wet leaves. Then I was speeding, then spinning, and now I'm sliding. Now at this point, I can see the headlines. You know, college kid dies in freak golf car accident. I can just see the headlines, you know. This is not the way I want to go down. You know, the tombstone, 2000 to 2004, under dummy. You know, not the way I want to go down. And then the stupid thing begins to tip. Now, at this point, there is nothing else to do except for bail. And so I dive headfirst out of that thing, roll, I'm dirty, things are falling over the golf court, smacks the ground, and it's down. Now, if my boss comes around at this time, which always happens, you know, when you do something dumb, somebody always comes by and sees it, nobody saw. And I have the chance now to redeem myself. But I've got to get this thing back on four wheels. And so kind of like a Herculean type thing, I went down, I put both hands under it, I lifted it, I threw it up on its side, and before I had the chance to celebrate, I realized that I didn't put the parking brake on. And now the golf cart, which had no control before, has now no control and no driver. And it went over the path, it went down a hill, and it took out some small trees. I thought I had control of it. I was convinced I had control of it. I didn't, as you can see. I had no control over it. It controlled me. It led me where it wanted it to go. And what I thought I had control of really had control of me. And when it comes to sin and things that separate us from the Lord, what we feel we have the most control of, in reality, control us. The way to find out if that's true or not is test yourself. Go without the thing that's keeping you from the Lord. It's funny, the flesh seems like a very weak thing until it's denied. If you've ever tried to fast for a meal, you think, well, just one meal, I can handle it. About 1 hour after lunch, you become this ravenous wolf, you know, looking for food. Denying the flesh is a difficult thing. And the sin that separates us often leads us to shame. But sin is not done there. Sin goes farther. The shame leads to slavery. Now, Israel, go back to verse 1 in chapter 9. Israel thinks all is well, and of course they do. It says, rejoice not, O Israel. The only reason he would say that is because Israel was rejoicing. They thought things were going well. Rejoice not for joy as other people, for thou hast gone a whoring from thy God, a very descriptive phrase. Thou hast loved a reward upon every corn floor. The floor and the wine press shall not feed them, and the new wine shall fail in her. Now here, verse 3, it shows the slavery. They shall not dwell in the Lord's land, but Ephraim shall return to Egypt. They shall eat unclean things in Assyria. Let's make a connection here. If you remember, Israel was split into two parts. The northern 10 tribes were called Israel, Ephraim, several others. The southern 2 tribes were called Judah. Judah was captured in 586 and went to a place called Babylon. This is where Daniel takes place. The first trial they had to deal with in Babylon was eating the king's meat and drinking the king's wine. Daniel and three others decided they were not going to do that. And they made a stand, and they've got a book named after them. There's no book of the Bible that refers to Israel's time in captivity, because no one stood. Their shame led to their slavery, and we have no good record beyond there, outside of the returns from exile. They were trapped. They returned. It says, return to Egypt, return to the world. And they'd eaten unclean things in Assyria. They were in slavery. Some people here perhaps are dealing with the same type of thing. There may be a sin or a love in your life that you just can't get past. You can't get rid of. A love of something wrong. And when we allow something to take us from God, or something from God's house even, we begin a path to slavery. But we all have great confidence in our flesh. We say, I could never go that far. I would never let it get out of hand. I wouldn't let it happen that way. Be very careful. As is often said, sin will take you farther than you want to go. It will keep you longer than you want to stay. And it will cost you more than you want to pay. In reviewing the lesson, there was a phrase that kept coming back to me in the book of James about sin and how it leads to shame and how it leads to slavery. And it was the phrase in James 1:15. Sin, when it is finished, bringeth forth death. When it comes to sin and loving things that are not godly things, it is not enough for sin to tarnish your testimony or to ruin your relationships. Sin's not done. It's just beginning. Sin is not done when your marriage is ended because of lust. Sin is not done when your family is wrecked because of alcohol or a drug addiction. Sin is not done when friendships are ruined because of gossiping and backbiting. Sin is not done yet. It keeps going. Sin is not done when someone is locked away in prison for a horrendous crime against man or nature. It is still beginning. Sin is only done when it takes the life of its victim. That's when sin is finished. And if something is so destructive and so harmful, why is it that we run to it? Why is it that we take solace under in its embrace, that we love it? Why do we run to it? It's very simple. It's because deep down in our fleshly, wicked hearts, we love it. We're not willing to give it up. You look at terrible things that are happening in the world. Look at people who are in abusive or destructive relationships. Women who stay with men who are abusers or alcoholics. The Bible calls them drunkards. Why do they stay with those men? They love them. You look at people who know that certain substance abuse is what they're prone to based on family history or whatever else. Why do they keep going back to the bars? Why do they keep going to the street corners for their fix? Why do they do that when they know it's wrong? Because they love it. Why do we keep doing the same thing we know is wrong? We know in our minds it's wrong. But it's almost as though we can't keep our flesh from doing it. It's because deep down, we love it. And it's only after we're willing to confess our love for this wrong that we can finally be restored. I think God has to teach Hosea this lesson. As Hosea is looking at his wife Gomer, who'd ran off and had illegitimate children, more realistically, with illegitimate lovers. As he takes all this into account, he realizes that the reason Gomer left him and ran from him is because Gomer never really loved him. Gomer loved her abomination. She loved her sin. And in the Christian life, we can come to church. We can give of a Sunday morning or a Sunday evening or a Wednesday evening or whatever other night you may come here. But unless our love is for God, just as Brother Tyler mentioned this morning, loves that do not glorify God are not real loves. Our foundation, the basis of it all, is God's glory. And if there are things we are involved in that do not bring glory to God, not to our family, not to ourselves, but to God only, these are things that if we're not careful, and if we don't give up, these are things that will turn to slavery and will lead to our demise. Now, I love the way he
he finishes up this area. We see the sin, the abomination, the shame that it leads to. And then the slavery. But there's one more S buried in here, right in the middle of the passage. Verse 5. And now we turn outward. Hosea makes the statement in verse 5. What will ye do in the solemn day? Based on the slavery that you now know is coming. And the entrapment that's waiting for you. He talks about the snare of the fowler. Literally, someone who traps birds or traps animals. That's what sin is looking for. Looking to trap you. Based on what we know now about sin and the shame and the slavery it leads to, now in the solemn day, what am I going to decide to do? The solemn day is a very serious thing. The word solemn means serious. Very earnest day. What are we going to do now? I used to have an idea that judgment was simply going to be the story of my life unfolded for everyone to see, as though there was some little angel with a camcorder watching my every move. It's far worse than that. Not only am I going to have to see my life and the things that I've done, but I'm going to have to give an account for them. I'm going to have to tell God my reasoning, my motives behind all that. And things that are done for Christ will last, and things that are not will be burned up as chaff and hay and wood and stubble. And if our lives ended right now, if 7:13 on this Sunday night were the last moment you were alive and you stood before God, it would be revealed what your love was and what my love was. If we've loved money, we may leave behind a huge bank account. If we love friends, we may leave behind many sad faces. If we love ourselves, we may leave behind a great deal of pleasures and of fortunes and fame and of worldly possessions. But if we love God, the testimony of our life will be very different. Our love for God ought to then affect our lifestyle. Remember, the greater our love for God, the greater the effect of our lifestyles will be. So how has the love of God changed you? How has it transformed you and me? How are we different now that we're Christians than we were when we were not Christians? Is it just a matter of morality or a matter of standards? Or has there been a real heartfelt conviction and transformation of a lifestyle? In Romans 12:2, it talks about conforming and transforming. Conforming is simply being pushed into a mold. Transforming is being completely changed. Paul says in 2 Corinthians 5:14, the love of Christ constraineth us. It holds us. And there are two ways we can view this. We can either view it as the love of Christ for Paul, or the love of Paul for Christ. Either way, our love will influence our lifestyle. If we love God, our lifestyle ought to reflect that. It ought to be changed. But it ought to be changed to a great degree. If we have a minimal love for God, we'll look for minimal commitments. Just heard the pastor speak to the choir. The number one thing, the C, commitment. A love for God will lead to an increased commitment. The choir director won't have to chase you down or make phone calls. If you love God, you'll be committed to the work of God. If we love God, we'll be committed to the work of the people of God and of the house of God. And the greater our love will be, the greater our lifestyle and the greater our impact will be. Some people have a love great enough for Sunday morning. That's it. God, I've fulfilled my commitment, my once a week thing. I'm done. I love you that much. Once a week love. Others may love him twice a week. Sunday morning, Sunday night. God bless all of you for being here. It'd be a very empty place if you weren't. Others extend to a third meeting, a Wednesday night. And yet others extend to week-long meetings in which we're always busy looking to do things for the Lord, looking to witness, not just going soul winning, but being soul winners. Not just worshiping in song, but worshiping throughout the week, giving God his rightful place in our life. And it all comes back to love and the love we have for God. We live as we love. And I have just a few questions before I turn the invitation over to the pastor. What is it, if you had to answer in one word, what is it right now that you love? Everything else that takes the place of God is shameful. You may love your family, and I hope you do love your family. But if a love for family eclipses your love for God, then a love for family can become a shameful thing. You may love your job, love what you do, I hope you do. But if that surpasses your love for God, then even your job has become a shameful thing. You may love friends, you may love money. Money of itself is not a bad thing, but Paul says the love of it is the root of all evil. What is it that you love? If we were to judge today what you loved, if you were to stand trial, would there be enough evidence to convict you that you love the Lord more than anything else? Or is God just one of those things on the list?